And good evening, everybody. Thanks for listening. This is Tom Harris. Welcome to Tom Harris USA, episode number 99, coming to you from a beautiful Chicago, Illinois. And it is beautiful for a change out here. As you all know, I was on vacation this past week, and I actually posted sort of a rerun show, one of the lost episodes that had to have been deleted off the server some time ago. And I do hope you don't mind that. I have three more of those, and they'll be coming out sometime in the next month or so. Going to kind of stagger them out until I finally have them all out there. And then all of the lost episodes will be back online. There will be three episodes that will not be back online, and that will be episodes 1 through 3. And, of course, if anybody wants those episodes, they should feel free to email me. The email address is tom@tomharrisusa.com, and I'll be happy to send them off to you. But in the meantime, I am doing this episode, and then the last episode will be episode number 100. Dun, dun, dun! After which the show will be going on hiatus for a brief time as I work on another project. Now, I'm getting closer, folks, to being able to tell you what's going on. And I do have a co-host for the show, and possibly some other people who will be guesting on the show as well. And I'm looking forward to just kind of having a change of pace and doing something different. And that is sort of, that's what it's all about. You know, I've been doing this show, this program, Tom Harris USA, for a year and a half now. And I do sometimes feel as though I'm kind of repeating myself a lot. And some people may be satisfied to do that and kind of talk about the same topics over and over again and rehash the same topics over and over again. But I've become very aware that that's what's going on with this program. And so that will be kind of a change, and we'll see some different kinds of things coming out of me. And hopefully, boy, that sounded bad, didn't it? Anyway, it was a very relaxing week. Now, the major thing about the past week, as you all know, I went to my family reunion up in Minnesota. And the place where we went is up near Painesville, Minnesota. It's one of the resorts on Lake Coronis, up there sort of in the central part of Minnesota, maybe central south. And it's just sort of northwest of Minneapolis. And a good time was had by all. Now, as I mentioned on a previous show, we have these family reunions every third year. So the last one was in 2007. This one, obviously, 2010. Next one will be 2013. And those are always such a good time. And, you know, 2 years along, you know, I kind of begin to think, oh, you know, I don't know. You know, is it going to be as good as it has been? And despite the fact that we had this hideous, hideous weather, it was a really, really good time. And I don't know if any of you have been paying attention to the weather here in the Midwest, the Midwest of the U.S. Now, I know Michael Moss out there probably has been because he likes weather. It has been extraordinarily hot and humid for the last couple of weeks. And I know I talked about this a couple episodes ago. And it just has been nasty and hot and sticky. And most of the time that we spent up near Painesville was hot and nasty and sticky and just kind of otherwise unpleasant. However, that was more than made up for by the company that I was keeping while I was up there. Because I have to say, I have the most awesome family ever. And I'm not even kidding about that. That's just such an incredible mix of people. And you really can't say much about, I mean, members of my family have such varying viewpoints and, you know, political views. And, you know, we have all stripes of people in my family. And despite that, everybody has this love and respect for each other and acceptance of each other, no matter who we are and no matter what we are. And it just has been one of the things in my life that I'm very thankful for, that I have such a fantastic family. And this will be, I think, remembered as a really, really fun reunion. Now, I was talking a bit last time about this sort of new thing that I'm trying. It's not new, of course, but it's new to me. And that is geocaching. I'm very happy to say that I did actually find some time during the course of the reunion to go out and find some caches. Now, I'm very kind of inexperienced in this, though I'm getting better at it. And certainly having a week out in, you know, sort of the countryside in Minnesota and being able to go and hunt for caches out there, it's been extremely educational because I'm learning a lot about, you know, the kind of things that people hide, the types of containers that people hide the caches in. And it has been a really, really interesting hobby. And I really want to thank Paul Edwards out there because he kind of spurred this on. Because he did a show over on United Kingdom Radio about geocaching and was recommending it. And it was sort of on a whim that I tried it. I'd heard about it before. But I really hadn't, you know, gone, it's one of those things that you hear about and they kind of go, well, you know, that kind of sounds cool, but I really don't have time for that. And as that couple weeks went on, I started to think more and more about it. And I started to think, well, I've got a major road trip coming up. So let me see how much these GPS devices are. And I kind of got the cheapest one that I could, and it's kind of a toy really, but it does the job, at least to some degree does the job. And its database is not perfect, but it's still pretty good. And it the sort of, I call it my Dragon Ball detector, if anybody out there is familiar with Akira Toriyama. And his, the anime series Dragon Ball, which I think is probably better known as Dragon Ball Z here in the U.S. They have this dragon, these mystical Dragon Balls, these treasures that these characters are looking for. And let's not have any dirty thoughts here, folks. It's not that kind of ball. Anyway, they have this thing called a Dragon Ball detector. It's kind of a radar that detects these things. And what I have is a sort of this GPS that sort of detects where these caches are. And it sort of points in a straight line. And it shows you where the 20 closest ones are. Now, the thing about it, and it's a little bit inconvenient, and probably at some point I'm going to have to get a proper GPS to do this, is that it points in a straight line to whatever cache is nearest you. And it doesn't matter if there's a highway in the way, or a road in the way, or a lake, or buildings, or whatever. So it just kind of points you in a straight line to wherever this thing is. And it's kind of up to you to drive around or ride around or walk around or whatever and find it. And there's plenty of these caches around me here in Chicago, and I probably am going to be finding a lot of them pretty soon. But, of course, I think it's probably more fun to do this out in the country. Because I tell you what, you know, and people who know about geocaching can kind of relate to this. I live in a city. In an urban area. So most of the caches here are very, very small, what they call in the geocaching community nanos. And they're very, very tiny, and usually there's just enough room in there for a log that you sign. And then you kind of roll it back up in this little container and put it back where it was. And that's the kind of caches that we have here. And I have to say, I much prefer the larger caches, the ones that are kind of out in the woods. They're larger containers. They can contain more of a variety of things. Now, most of the stuff that you find in these caches I'm finding are just kind of worthless trinkets, you know, sort of little toys, or people will sometimes put a calling card in to say that they found the cache. And I realized before I was setting off on this trip that I was going to need stuff to put into these geocaches. And now I have a few little things around, things that I was going to give away as prizes on my live show, and I just kind of have, and I have a couple things that I am giving away, but those are set aside, so don't worry. Mikey, you're going to get your map. But I decided that I'm going to put some of those things in geocaches, the smaller things. And I also decided for some of the bigger caches, what I was going to do was put together a little CD. And the CD will have some of my shows on it, and I have two Tom Harris USA episodes on it, and a Plain Dudes Radio episode that I put together on conspiracy theories, and then one of the live shows on there. And then an introductory little clip saying, well, if you found this, then you must be a geocacher, and I kind of give some details about how I got into it. And hopefully the people will enjoy it. Now, the one thing I didn't think of was making these CDs trackable. And so maybe people will pass them around. So I'm kind of hoping that the next round of these that I do, if I do any more of them, will be of that nature. And I left three of them. I made six of them. And I left three of them in caches in Minnesota. And hopefully the other three will follow. And then maybe I won't do any more. It's just kind of an experiment. And we'll just see how it works. But I found a real treasure. And I was off hunting caches probably the third day of my vacation. It was one of those hot days, but I kind of found some time in the afternoon that I didn't really have anything to do. And I went out and I found my first geocoin. And for those who are not familiar, this is actually a physical coin, metal coin. This is beautifully enameled. And this is one of the Fallen Heroes coins. And that is sort of a coin that was minted to commemorate one of our veterans who was killed in Iraq or Afghanistan. And this happens to be a coin for somebody who was killed in Iraq. And they request on the webpage, when you go in to track it, that you not keep it, that you keep it moving. So I've actually brought that coin, which I found in Painesville, back here to Chicago. And now I'm just kind of looking around for a suitable cache to put it in. And then somebody else will come and get that. And it will continue its journey and you know, have kind of remind people of the sacrifices of our veterans. And I think it's a really important thing to remember. I don't talk much about politics on this show, or I talk about politics in a very much more general way. But I do think that that's a nice gesture. And there's a lot of people out there who geocache. So anyway, I do have to once again thank Paul Edwards for getting me started in this. And right now I'm very enthusiastic about it. We'll see if I'm still enthusiastic about it after I found all the caches that are kind of near me. And there are plenty of them around, but you know, as time goes on, I'm going to have to move further and further away to find them. And maybe eventually I'll start hiding caches of my own, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, so that was kind of fun. That was a good aspect of this vacation. And the one thing, though, that I have found, and I guess I've kind of found it out the hard way, is that when you're crawling through the woods and you're looking for these things, be prepared to get poison ivy. Be prepared to get burrs. Be prepared for all sorts of unpleasantness and mud and bugs and so forth. But even with that, even with those few drawbacks, the excitement of finding a cache, especially when you're a newbie like me, is just really incredible. Anyway, I was up in Minnesota, and I found 8 caches in one day. And that was kind of my last day, Friday, when I had time, and the weather was a little bit cooler. In between severe thunderstorms, there were these periods where it was very, very clear and nice and cool. And so I finally went out after this very, very hot week, where I'd found a few caches, but not too many. And went out and actually kind of went along the Glacial Ridge Trail, which is a kind of a biking and hiking trail, and found 8 caches in one day. And that was sort of my record day, and I'm doubting that I'm going to surpass that one anytime soon. But it does seem as though there are certain parts of the country that are sort of covered. There's a lot of them around. And my little detector doesn't detect all of them, and part of that is because it doesn't have any of the real new ones. It's sort of, they have to be in place for about 6 months before they'll show up in the database. So anyway, I've babbled on long enough about geocaching, but I will have to say, it's a lot of fun. And I think it would be even more fun if I'd had somebody with me to do this with. I'd kind of put out some feelers to various members of the family who I thought would be interested. But they all had other stuff they were doing. And quite understandable because, when you visit with your cousins and your aunts and uncles and you don't see them very often, it is very much, a temptation not to want to go anywhere. You want to kind of stay and visit. And I did plenty of visiting at the family reunion, but I also did find some time to get away and to do a little bit of treasure hunting. So that's way cool. Okay, so I do have an email comment here on the last show, and this comes from our good friend Robert in Iceland. And Robert was commenting on the geocaching topic. Robert says, "Hi, Tom. Another very interesting show, and one subject in particular caught my attention, geoboxes. These sound rather similar to a pastime I used to be interested in called letterboxing, a pastime that has its roots on my native Dartmoor. If I understand correctly, it started way back in time when travelers would cross the moor and either post or retrieve the letter from a hidden box. One would check the box, and if it contained a letter whose address was one in which the traveler was passing, he/she would take the letter on. In more modern times, it has become sort of a hunt in which the walkers seek to find a letterbox and contained within is usually a rubber stamp and a book. One takes an impression of the rubber stamp. It used to be a real achievement to collect 100 impressions and then be admitted into the 100 Club in the honor of placing one's own letterbox upon the moor. Alas, they are so plentiful now that I am minded to form a non-letterbox club in which one might walk the moor without finding a box. I did once find a letterbox at King's Tor, and it was placed by a man from America. Should one want a more easy way to collect letterbox stamps, then most of the pubs on or close to the moor have them. I trust you had a restful break, my good friend, Robert Lewis Pels. Well, thank you very much, Robert, for your email. Now, that the rubber stamp thing reminds me a little bit of what I was doing when I was traveling in Britain last year, last August. Oh, gotcha, it's been over a year now. When Paul and I hiked on the Hadrian's Wall path, because on the Hadrian's Wall path, there were boxes every so often along the trail where there'd be a rubber stamp and you could stamp your little passport that you get at the beginning of the trail. And you get the 5 rubber stamps and then the last stop at the very end of the trail at Bonus on Solway, you would actually get the little certificate, which I have over in my kitchen, actually. And it seems obvious to me from what you're saying that letterboxing is sort of a predecessor to geocaching, and I wouldn't be surprised if geocaching has sort of surpassed it at this point because of GPS being so much more accurate, and maybe it's a little easier to find the boxes rather than kind of hunting through the moors for them. But it does sound very, very similar, obviously, and still sounds pretty darn cool. So anyway, thanks again for that email. And if anyone else would like to send email, they're more than welcome to. The email address for the show is tom@tomharrisusa.com. All right, so now comes another edition of my new feature, Tom's Travels. And today I'm going to be talking a little bit about Belgium. Now, Belgium was a place I first went in 1988. This is sort of a hopping off point for me because this was the first mainland European country that I went to when traveling independently. Because my first trip, I was obviously with a large group of people. And the second trip, I was traveling on my own. And I actually did a kind of a path through Northern Europe, which took me up to Finland for my best friend's wedding. And my kind of kicking off point was Ostend in Belgium, which is a major ferry port, and still to this day, you go back and forth from Ostend to, to Dover in England. And so this was actually where I chose to kind of begin my journey across. Now, it was my first time in Belgium, and I have to say, Belgium is a beautiful country, but it has some of the most boring cities in Europe. I have to say. Now, the first city, I didn't go there on my first trip. I kind of passed through there on my second trip to Belgium, which is 1996, was the beautiful medieval city of Bruges. And the authorities in Bruges have gone to a lot of trouble to keep the center of the old center of town looking as though they're medieval buildings. Now, the original buildings aren't all authentically medieval, though they were, there are a lot of authentic medieval buildings in the center of Bruges, but many others were sort of restored during the Victorian era. So you kind of have a mixture of real medieval and fake medieval buildings. But nonetheless, it's a beautiful little town, and I was only there for a few hours, so I really can't talk much about it, but I seem to remember these moats. Maybe they call them canals there. I'm not really sure, like in Amsterdam, but they looked more like moats to me. And it gives the whole town a rather charming aspect and one that is very evocative of the Middle Ages. And they do a pretty good job, I think, of blending the more modern restorations in with the original buildings. And sometimes it's actually really, really hard to tell. But there's a lot of cafes and things in Bruges. It is very much a tourist city. But at the same time, it's also a working city. It is actually one of the capitals of one of the Belgian provinces. And there's a lot to see and kind of soak up the ambiance of Bruges. Now, one of the other fond memories I have of Belgium is the train rides. Actually just sitting on the train. And I took a local train out of Ostend. It wasn't one of these express trains. So I took a train that actually took its sweet time. getting from Ostend to Brussels. And it passed through a lot of just absolutely gorgeous countryside. And it is one of those places that I want to go back to as long as I can avoid Brussels. And I'll tell you why. Brussels isn't an interesting enough town, in my opinion, to rate its own 15-minute segment. Now, there are some interesting things to see in Brussels. Some of the churches are quite interesting, including Notre Dame de Lorraine, which is where the kings and queens of Belgium are buried. Even though it was actually a 19th century church, I still found it very interesting. Also near the center of Brussels is the Comic Strip Museum, which if you're into comics, and I've explained that I am, I thought that it was a really, really interesting way to spend about 3 or 4 hours, was to go in. And, of course, the concentration of the museum is Belgian artists and Belgian cartoonists. So you have a lot of original works by Peyo, who created the Smurfs, of Georges Remy, who is also known as Hergé, who created the character Tintin, as we know him here in the States. And that's a comic strip that has been near and dear to my heart since I was a kid. So, of course, it was really, really cool to go into the comic strip museum and see the life-size statue of Tintin that was apparently at once in one of the city parks of Brussels. I imagine they probably must have had problems with vandalism because they moved it into the museum. But in addition to comic strips and original artwork, they also had a lot of toys and a lot of sort of the spin-offs and merchandise from a lot of these various comic strips. Now, I imagine that these displays have changed a lot since I was there in 96 when I visited the comic strip museum. So it definitely would be worth a return visit, at least, and see what has changed. Because Belgium, of course, is known for its comic book artists. Now, the other thing that Belgium is perhaps even better known for among the general population is its beer. Now, I'm not a fan of beer, so I really don't have a lot to say on the topic. However, there is one type of Belgian beer that I actually quite like, and that would be lambic, which is sort of a beer which is brewed with fresh fruit. And there have been some really interesting flavors of lambic available commercially in the U.S. And I imagine that there are probably even more interesting flavors that have come out in Belgium. But certainly if you're a beer lover, Belgium can't be ignored. Now, to get back to Brussels, since I kind of went off track there, you have to say that the big attraction in Brussels, and I really fail to see why this is such a big attraction, is the mannequin piss. Come on, folks. If you had the statue in the U.S., it would probably be torn down as child pornography. But it's a very famous fountain with a little statue of a teeny little boy at the top who's peeing. And some people find this thing absolutely charming. And, of course, everywhere you go, you see postcards and trinkets and chocolates, like the kind of those nasty Mozart chocolates I talked about when I was talking about Salzburg. And it's just out of all proportion to what this thing is. It's kind of a homely fountain, kind of overdone. And to make things even worse, they dress this little statue of a peeing boy up in costumes. Maybe they're doing that to get around the law or whatever. I don't know. I guess people are just so fond of this nasty little statue that they feel they have to dress the thing up. Very, very sad. And to think that that is the attraction of a city that's been there for 1,000 years just makes you imagine how boring is this place. It seems to me, now, I'm not dissing Brussels, really, not, because it is kind of just like a lot of other European cities. And maybe that's really kind of Brussels' problem. But there are some attractions, and I would say that the Royal Palace and the museums that are sort of adjacent to the Royal Palace are of particular interest. The Art Museum is particularly good. Of course, that to me is the highlight of Brussels, is the churches and the museums. I have to say, though, that it's not a place that I want to go to again and again. And it seems to me, and I don't know if this is true of other, of Europeans in general, they see the Belgians as being rather uptight and a little bit cold. Because that's certainly how I found the Belgians in general. And I don't know if that's because that they're, you know, there's squabbles sort of between the northern part of Belgium and the southern part of Belgium. They have a kind of a dual linguistic system there. Some people speak Flemish, Some people speak French, and I believe it's the Southerners speak French, and the Northerners speak Flemish. And maybe for that reason, people are a little bit uptight. But overall, I have to say, you know, definitely Bruges, if you're going to Belgium, is worth a look, because just the architecture, and obviously Bruges has a lot of charm. It's something that Brussels really doesn't have. Despite the fact that there are some interesting things to see in Brussels, I wouldn't give Brussels more than a day or two, because, quite frankly, there's not that much to see. And the popular tourist attractions, which include the Mannequin Piss, are kind of all right down in the same area. And, of course, you do have a large square. It's called the Big Market. I believe it's called the Grote Market. During the summer, you can see a lot of, you know, street musicians and that sort of thing there. But it's not a particularly friendly city, and there aren't a particular large number of things that are really worth seeing there. So Belgium, not my favorite country. Now, moving on, I'm going to talk a little bit about a city, and this is not really worth a whole 15-minute segment, but it's worth about 3 minutes. And that is the little town, it's in Bavaria, called Bayreuth. Now, if it may sound familiar, if you're interested in opera, and in particular, the work of Richard Wagner. And, of course, I'm a big Wagner fan from way, way back. And of course, I'm an opera fan from way, way back as well. In fact, back when I was 19 years old, I was one of the co-founders of Friends of the Opera of Southwest Florida. And I could talk about opera another time, perhaps. Now, the thing about Bayreuth is that it was the home of Richard Wagner, and the Wagner house is still there. There's not much in there. It's a museum, and you pay a couple bucks to go in. Interesting house. Nothing really extraordinary about it, and all the furnishings and things that were there when Wagner was there are gone now, because after Wagner's death, they kind of had to sell all of his belongings to pay off some of his debts. So he's a very interesting character, and you'd be well served to do your own research into Wagner and his music. But I'm going to talk a little bit about Bayreuth, because the big attraction in Bayreuth, of course, is the Bayreuth Festival, which happens every year and is predominantly devoted to the works of Wagner. And Bayreuth Festival takes place at the Festspielhaus, which is a 19th century opera house designed by Wagner. And it is actually a unique floor plan and design. It was designed to have fantastic acoustics. And certainly for a 19th century opera house, it was way ahead of its time. And the Festspielhaus itself, if you're interested in the architecture of theaters, is definitely a highlight of Europe. There don't seem to be a lot of tourist amenities in Bayreuth, at least not affordable ones. And I took it as a day trip out of Nuremberg, and it's about, I think it was about a half an hour trip by train. But definitely worth a look, and particularly if you're a fan of Wagner. Though you do have to be very careful, especially during the summer, that you don't plan a visit to Bayreuth during the festival. Because obviously, it's a very, very popular place during the festival. There's probably no accommodation anywhere near Bayreuth. And the crowd that the Bayreuth Festival draws is a very, very posh crowd. So you can count on things costing a lot of money. I was there in the off-season, didn't really have any problems with that myself. But it is something to watch out for. So that was Tom's Travels for this week. Next time I'm going to talk a little bit about another city in Germany, Berlin. And maybe if I have time, I'll talk a little bit about Bosnia-Herzegovina. Because that's a place that I was briefly, I didn't get to stay there for really any length of time. But certainly it's a place that I think is worth talking about. Anyhow, I'm going to wrap up the show now. I'm kind of running short on time. As always, thanks for listening. Now, there is the live show still on Saturday afternoon at 4 p.m. UK time, which is 10 a.m. here in Chicago, 11 a.m. on the east coast of the U.S. And you can go listen to the live show at unitedkingdomradio.co.uk. The show on before me, of course, is Chris Reardon at 3 p.m., which would be 9 a.m. here in the States. And I am followed by a new presenter. So that will be awesome, because I haven't heard this guy yet. So it promises to be a really good time. And as always, if you want to email the show, you can write at tom@tomharrisusa.com. All right, so I'm out of time. Thanks for listening. This is Tom in beautiful Chicago, Illinois, signing off. We'll see you next time.